And there's like pioneer scarves were part of the attire for many school children at the festive events. But there seems to have been no major clashes between children, parents and teachers of different political views at that time. And in a way, this is something that I want to go deeper into, because in, as the 80s went on, I think the school was understood mostly as a cultural school, with its political background somewhat overcome. And in a way, it makes sense that the school of the 80s, in a way, wanted to get rid of that political reputation that it had, because at those times, the hard years were behind. So this, as the school was dependent on the money from the Soviets, there seems to have been a lack of everything, and not the salaries even were not really ascertained. So financially, when these times were done, there seems to have been an idea of normalization, becoming more respectable, and in a way you can see that it has been alluring to the school administration, and even to the let's say through the teachers, even the school pupils themselves. So the special status of the school is as experimental force field in the Finnish-Soviet relations, and an expression of these forces is, I think, undeniable. But the reason to get into these details that I've been now going into is not to meant to overwhelm with historical nuance. In fact, this is the historical unpacking of different phases of the school has been, it's been a rather patchy and quick, and rather I would like to give an idea of contrasting forces at work here that have been shaping and bending the educational apparatus, negotiating ideologies and political realities, emerging and clashing, like behind the surface of what is easy to see as a unified history. So if there's one thing that I would like to stick with you is that there has been not really a teleology or a, like a story behind the school, but it has been more of a sort of a battleground of different ideologies. Now, moving into my more personal take of my own recollections of my years in this school, I think it's fair enough to start with a confession. This is not like merely personal, but more of a generational in scope, I believe. In fact, Kristina Shulgin, I found out that she had made a documentary in 1993 called Miksi en puhu Venäjä, Why I Don't Speak Russian. And it tells the fates of Russian emigres from the Finnish autonomy to the 1970s. I haven't seen it, but the name really cuts to the center of what I'm about to say, because my confession is the fact that I didn't really learn to speak good Russian in school. Although I spent all my preschool, elementary, junior high and high school years here, 13 years altogether, and when I matriculated in 97, it was not uncommon for my classmates to choose in matriculation examination to write short Russian course, not the long one, even though the long one in a way was par our curriculum, like it was not on that level, the long one. So I did the long one and many did, but also the short Russian course was not was also kind of like wanted to be taken. Of course, this confession, this is a subjective thing. It's not easy to measure how good somebody speaks a language. Of course, I know the language, and in fact, because of the I've been later to exchange student in St. Petersburg, I speak it, you know, rather well. But I'm talking about those times when I left the school. I think that I can say as a generational thing that there was ill of ease with this language, and this is the thing that I kind of want to address, because there are of course a lot of exceptions, and some older students of the school were very fluent and in fact better than us, and of course this is subjective again, but And it might, most probably it has changed. So I'm not really, you know, saying anything about that the school can't teach Russian language. I'm not making that kind of claim at all. But from that point of view, from the 90s perspective, I feel that there was something that those at least who have gone through Finnish school system and being taught Swedish language at school can relate to this feeling of being kind of like ill at ease or not really wanting to use that kind of language that they were educated in, although also Swedish is taught, it takes many years, it starts on third, right? Third. Well, anyways, I think this, like, these Finnish school children who have no direct connection with to Swedish speaking population have a kind of like similar feeling maybe to what I'm trying to present as a picture, in a way that it's a valid comparison, even though this is not like the whole of the story. So what is the whole story? Story of a generation that didn't learn to speak the foreign language in the language school they attended. As we all know, or at least we should know, be aware by now, these kind of stories, they're like fiction, especially autobiographical stories that are told about one's own accomplishments or failures. They're to some extent dangerous, even more so if you want to represent somebody else through this story, as I'm now telling it to you. These kind of stories are suspect because they assume in their form something that is referred in literary studies with the word exemplum, which means combination of a moral anecdote and a central point of reference. So this structure calls for an identification with me, and to it puts me as an exemplary figure who is now telling you something about his own upbringing. And this process is by necessity insensible to what is unlike and different in the circumstances and backgrounds of these figures that we are. And of course, it's insensitive to how somebody remembers, how one chooses to convey, express, etc., choose words for their own experiences. Storyteller calls the listener to read or reader to identify with him or her, and this is problematic act because it goes through identification and the model of example. Now, so what's problematic with identification? I just very briefly want to refer to Azad Haider, who in his book Mistaken Identity goes pretty nicely through these problems of telling story, of referring in a quote from Haider. I should give a small quote. In liberal discourse, power relations are equated with the law, but actually they are being produced and exercised in a range of social practices, and one of them, of course, is the classroom. It's the school. It is in institutions that collectivities of people are separated into individuals, subjects that are being subordinated to a dominating power. So in a very, very encapsulated short philosophical interlude to this whole story, I would like to point out that the story that sets out an example relies on the process of identification on the part of you to me. And we are all to some extent subjectified in similar circumstances. That is, I believe that you went to school, you were schooled, you all have been to classrooms, to cafeterias, you've been working with pupils, you have experiences of teachers, and so forth. So I kind of like presume that you're able to identify with my story because you can draw on your own experiences of school, and the differences are the things that make my story possibly interesting to you, because you don't have my experiences. This is something that is makes it a good story, hopefully. But what we fail to address in this kind of situation is that when we rely on identifications, the process of production or producing that subjectivity, the institutional powers power relations behind this production process, and the meanings that attach to that don't come up. We are given narratives and stories, and not the machinations that make them work. So, in a way, it's an abstraction if I say that my generation did not really learn Russian in school very well or very good Russian. And this abstraction, although it might be rather good one or accurate in some respect, we need to put it back into the specificities of material relations that don't really show up in this abstraction. And I want to quote Louis Althusser, who said, "It is impossible to choose one's beginnings. We all have to be born someday, somewhere, and start thinking and writing in a given world." In fact, he was referring to Marx in this quote, but it applies to us all, no matter if we're like giants of philosophy or not. So, as I'm inviting you to identify with my subjective point of view, this corresponds to my need of being understood. Yet there are in this story some workings that cannot be understood unless they are examined quite specifically, and this is what I hope to do next for a short time. Try to answer why I was subjectified the way I was. Why was I? How I came, or how did we come from this school in the 90s the way we did? How we came from it? And to get to these material questions, we need some background information. First of all, spatial and demographic information. Spatially, the thing that separates all language schools from the ordinary neighborhood schools is the fact that they are more often applied to by parents who do not live in the immediate vicinities, immediate areas. So when pupils gather from around Helsinki area, they lose that connection of the school and its neighborhood that's kind of like more continuous for normal schools. Let's say like that, let's put it like that. On the other hand, these children gain the ability to move in different situations and social settings, and in a way the school is more strictly separated from their other daily activities. And I believe this is something that most people who go to language schools or special schools can identify with or can understand. But this leads to another thing, because the pool of students is more heterodox than in a school of a certain district or area, and the pool of pupils is less likely to reflect the general demographic. In what I'm getting here is that my classroom always had more girls than boys. Looking at my class photos from 1986 to 1994, there's a steady variation of 5 to 7 boys and 12 to 17 girls. So there was like a pronounced difference. Now, as I entered the school, I can't really remember that Russian was being spoken in the recesses or lunch hours or in the school area. Some teachers, of course, were of Russian origin, but they generally spoke Finnish as well. So as to teach Finnish-speaking children, they needed to, which almost everybody did. In the mid-80s, my principal teacher on the first four grades was bilingual, with Russian being her mother tongue, and other teachers might not really know Russian at all, but from the fifth grade on, my principal teacher was much stronger in Russian, but also learning Finnish at the same time. So I had this, we had this experience of teachers that they might be not very good in Finnish, but at the same time, because of the almost all of the pupils spoke Finnish as their mother tongue, we knew that the teachers would need to kind of like catch up on us. So some pupils would speak Russian at home, or they would have family ties with Russian speaking families, but this was exception by far. Like, out of the 744 students at the year I started school, 85-86, only 37 spoke Russian as their mother tongue. So this is like a 5%, like a one out of 20, one in a classroom kind of setting. Now, as the 80s went on, this was like, this was the time of Mikhail Gorbachev, Perestroika. I remember on a field trip to Batumi, Georgia, on the fourth grade, I bought a t-shirt that said, "All you need is glasnost." And I was very pleased with that shirt, and I was sad to see it lose its shape when it was washed. But as a kid, this was the kind of like the atmosphere that the school was in. That it was now the most famous thing that happened by far was in 1989 during the 80s when Raisa Gorbachova visited the school, and now I'm happy to say that here we have Laura's kid brother there with a Soviet flag in his hand. He's being kind of like adopted by Raisa for that occasion because he's wearing this military hat. Probably you can say something.
It was
a great public PR moment for the Soviet Union, of course, and Raisa Gorbachova did a lot of this. He also kissed a baby or held a baby in the center of Helsinki when he was there. So, but anyways, this all came to an end pretty abruptly in the 90s with the dissolution of Soviet Union. This, in a way, this is the swan song moment of the Soviet-Finnish relationship. This in a way encapsulates it nicely. All these gray guards in the background as well. It's very, very well. It looks very, very of its time. It's from the national TV news. It made the news. So where Laura's kid brother was very known for this for this thing for some time. But then the Soviet Union collapsed, and accompanying it was this economic depression in the beginning of the 90s, immigration of mostly Ingrian, also Russian and Estonian people to Finland, that was really heavily felt here in the school. To me and my class, this meant accommodating new students who knew very little or none Finnish at the beginning, and they would learn, of course, but initially these pupils would literally speak no Finnish. And if I went back to my old class photos from 91 to 94, which reflect the peak years of this immigration, the ratio between Russian as first language students and Finnish as first language students was something like 9 to 24, 9 to 19, 8 to 18. So it was not exactly half, but more than one third of the classroom that accommodated new school kids. So in a way, we were like nowadays it said in Finnish maahanmuuttajakoulu, immigration school those years. This slightly exaggerates the demographical change. Like in those years, there was 122 out of 608 students were Russian speaking, so it was not so heavy on all classes, but on ours it for some reason was. And while in my class this was it was felt very heavily. And here this is an interesting graph that I found from the Russian speaking immigration into Finland. Here you can see these are the years 91, 92, 93, and you can see the huge tower in the first, and this is it's what it is related to is the existing population of Russian speakers in Helsinki. So you see, that although the starting from 1990 the graphs go quite like linearly, but because there were so few Russian speakings to begin with, it felt like a really like a big amount of people because it was so homogeneous in the end of the 80s. So this was what happened in 91, 92, 93 that had a very pronounced effect in this. And what these statistics is meant to show, first of all, is that SVKO was as foreign to Russian-speaking people in the end of the 80s as the whole of Finnish society, and secondly, to draw attention to the suddenness of this breaking of this homogeneous bubble that happened when the Soviet Union collapsed. And in my situation, especially going back to my own experiences, as my class had so few boys to start with, I was in a situation in my junior high that I would be in a class that had one Finnish-speaking boy plus me. And there would be 5 to 4 Russian-speaking boys, and in fact one Estonian. Now, as referred to earlier, school was separate from the rest of the reality in a way. As you notice from these premises, in a way, this is also a very secluded place. And it, I think this also has to do with the willingness of the Museovirasto to let this place be demolished in a way. If it would be more integrated into its surroundings, in the architecture of its surroundings, that would make a difference. But in a way, this location is in a way reflects something of that isolation, I think, that the Finnish society and us as students were experiencing at the time. This split I think I need to pretty soon quit, but I'm trying to get into the end. But what I think was significant in this immigration wave, so to speak, was that I didn't make friends with the Russian-speaking pupils, and I suspect not many of my classmates did. This is, of course, is subjective again, but this is my feeling, that the language barrier stayed there in place even after the actual period of being tongue-tied could have been overcome, especially for the Russian-speaking children or pupils, because they were kind of like, in fact, it happened so that when we went to the later on, the classes were separated along the language lines. So it was kind of like reflected in the school curriculum. This does not reflect all of the decisions that were made at those times, but in my case, it was so that when I matriculated in 97, there was like a Finnish-speaking group and a Russian-speaking class. So I didn't know much what was going on in the Russian-speaking class. I was in the other side. So this name of this talk has been Immigration as Actualization, and unpacking the history of the school as well as my own experience as a pupil of the school has been an attempt to come to the point where we can meet these terms. And I believe my experience, my generation's experience of immigrations, was compounded with many other things like economic depression, the sort of hopelessness that came with the post-Soviet times in Finland, and also, of course, we were teenagers then, so that, of course, we were inexperienced. We didn't really have the kind of, we didn't know what it was for us. It was happening for the first time, of course, we didn't know. But what I believe that what was actualized and given a very concrete reality in a way was, this is the most difficult thing to grasp, because I think the way we were already at that age, in a way, subjectified to a certain problematic distancing behavior, distance towards conflicts, distance towards bodily sensations. I think this is something that the school of those years, in a way, schooled us into. It's like this subjectification through the school was through these phenomena. And I think, in fact, that is something that this was, of course, similar to what happened in families. It was not a bubble. It was, but there was a feeling that that we were somehow, I don't know, protected from Russianness in a way. I think the school, as it was protecting us from its own history that had been economically dire and politically conflicting, and as the situation got into the immigration in the 90s, there was a sort of a felt threat towards the school that was not really never overcome. So this is, I think, why we were sheltered or could not be in a way integrated with these Russian-speaking kids. This is the culture that, in a sense, we, because of that, we missed something. Even us, you know, we were the children of the 80s, the yuppie times, the liberal 80s. But when it came to end, I think, on the other hand, that this history that is, you know, now it is close to us, it's gone. It in a way needs to be actualized in a way that in the present, precisely because it already once has been. We cannot help but to feel in a way embarrassed by the question, why didn't you learn Russian at school? You went to Finnish Russian school. In a similar way that probably many Finns are embarrassed by the question, why didn't you learn Swedish in school? So we do not need to reproduce, I think, these attitudes and reservations of a bygone years. And in a way, we are quite free of them already. If we look at our children's generation, if we look what's going on around us, we are, in a way, already completely in a different place. So what I've been trying to strive at with this lecture is that kind of like free us from those memories, in a way, that by confronting them and not to reproduce these antiquated positions and postures. In a way, I think our society and our schooling system nowadays has probably, hopefully, means to do so. So I believe that, contrary to those who see immigration a threat, that in fact it is a situation of confronting those beliefs that are built during an isolation or during fear. And even as this confrontation might fail, as in a way it did, I think, in the 90s, the meaning that it would not break the isolation, it holds out a certain promise of rethinking or reorienting or starting afresh those historical subjective makings that it shows out, that it delineates in a way. So to end with a bit of a joke, I think many of the jokes that went on in the school are not worth reproducing, but this one is. I'm happy to show in the last picture me holding the statue of Lenin with my friend Otto, and Laura is there in the 1995 when the school was celebrating its 40th anniversary. So in this spirit, I'm hoping that we could start anew, even if it means sometimes going back and confronting old ghosts. Thank you. Пожалуйста.